The Dr. Peter Bragan Hour, Mondays at 5 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, and Medication Madness? It's the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour with guests and callers seeking the truth about psychiatry and psychotherapy and how you can make the most of your own life right here on the Progressive Radio Network.
And this is Dr. Peter Bragan. Today could be a very interesting show. Before telling you about my guest, and thinking about one of the most satisfying experiences I have as a psychiatrist and a therapist, and that is to see people blossom, flower, expand, grow as they get removed from psychiatric drugs while having a good conversation about how to improve their lives. When people come off psychiatric drugs, they almost always feel more alive, more alert. They have their emotions. Today, one of my patients was telling me that she heard stories on 9/11 that actually brought tears to her eyes. It was the first time in her memory, being on psychiatric drugs for many years, that she could recall having tears. She has a more rich emotional life. Her sense of humor is coming back. There's a twinkle in her eye. She's not even completely off, but she's well beyond half off of the psychiatric medications that she came to me on. What's this all about? What does this tell us? Too often, people talk to me about psychiatric medication. They act as if there are two alternatives. There's psychiatric medication, and what do you have to offer, Dr. Bragan? What a narrow view of life. When people get anxious, depressed, scared, they have all the alternatives available in life. When Teddy Roosevelt lost his wife, he went to Africa on safari and shot animals and took photos of himself standing over dead animals. Supposedly, it got him through his depression. Not my approach. Not my approach. But there are so many approaches. People go to India. People find new love. People convert to religion. People have all kinds of experiences that strengthen them. They learn new philosophies, new psychologies, read better books. And some find better counselors or therapists. But the contest is not between psychiatric drugs and what Peter Bragan has to offer. It's a false dichotomy. It is between psychiatric drugs and a drug-free mind. That's what it's between. It's between psychiatric drugs and a drug-free mind and heart and spirit. And then, with the drug-free mind, all of life is the alternative. Not my therapy, your therapy, or anybody in particular's therapy, but all that life can offer to a human being who finds the courage and self-determination to move on, which is often very hard to do on psychiatric drugs. And because of what I call medication spellbinding, I describe it in Medication Madness, medication spellbinding, people don't even know what they're missing when they're on psychiatric drugs. You'll hear people say, who come out of a bad marriage and find true love, that they didn't know what they were missing. Well, it's the same with people who take psychiatric drugs. Now, if you want to take psychiatric drugs for a short time, if you feel that having less emotional pain is what you need at the moment, or having an artificial boost is what you need at the moment, just keep in mind that in the long run, if you stay on psychiatric drugs, they will always, always reduce your ability to engage life, to immerse yourself in life, to enjoy life. Now, all this is very relevant to my guest today, who is Dr. Allison Wilder. I love her name, Allison Wilder. Allison is a certified therapeutic recreation specialist, parentheses CTRS. She's an assistant professor in the Recreation Management and Policy Department at the University of New Hampshire, a really wonderful place to live and work, I'll bet. She's got 25 years of experience in a field that she identifies as recreation and leisure services. And if you think that's just cream puff stuff, she works and has worked in youth corrections, aging, physical disability, and developmental disability. In a note to me, Allison wrote that she likes to assist people in identifying what moves and motivates them in life. What a better approach than identifying your diagnosis in the DSM and making you more immobile and less motivated with psychiatric drugs. I welcome Allison, who wants to move and motivate people in life. Welcome to the show, Dr. Wilder.
Welcome to me. Thank you so much, Peter. It's a pleasure to be here today.
Tell folks about what you do. What is recreational therapy and leisure services all about?
Well, we have a little joke in our profession, and we like to joke that recreation therapy is the most exciting health-related profession that you've never heard of. We are a relatively new profession, having sort of fomented as a profession in the mid-20th century, around the 1950s and 1960s. But the ideas and approaches that we use are by no means new. You can look back to ancient physicians who would use recreation in the treatment of soldiers and illness and so forth. So we see even as far back as recorded history that recreation emerges as a way to help people gain wholeness in their life who are facing some sort of deficit. One of my favorites is Florence Nightingale. She, I like to think of her as the mother of recreation therapy, and she recognized the healing properties of activities that are engaging and an environment that is soothing and pleasant. So we've really taken off with some of those earlier concepts and have created this profession called recreation therapy. One little point I'd like to make before I go much further, Peter, is that you may hear me interchange recreational therapy and therapeutic recreation. That's a function of the newness of our profession, and both terms should be construed as synonymous for your listeners. I hope that's helpful.
Okay. Well, go ahead and just talk some more about what you do. I'm sure everyone who's listening to this just wants to hear more about it.
Right. Okay. Well, I'm one voice among many, and there are going to be different philosophical positions, just as there are within your field, but I think I'll do a fairly decent job of representing the whole of the profession. We like to think of the profession of recreation therapy as being purposeful intervention. And by that, what I mean is that it is a therapy, and we do follow what's called the so-called clinical process. We will assess our clients, we'll develop a plan for them, we'll implement that plan, and then we'll evaluate the effectiveness of that plan based on targets or outcomes we were shooting for. By and large, what we're trying to do is help people to attain positive behavioral change. And that may be functional, or it may be just in the way, you know, for example, the way they walk, the way they move through space, the way they interact physically. But it may also be behavioral changes in the sense of how they view the world, how engaged they are, how they feel about themselves or the relationships with other people. So it's quite broad. Our services are typically aimed at folks who are identified as having disabilities or illnesses, and those can be any kind of illness. We don't technically distinguish between physical illnesses or mental illness. People have some sort of issue, and we're there to help with that. We tend to use leisure or recreation as our activities or our modality. So where a physical therapist might use trips in the parallel bars, we're going to affect maybe some walking. We're going to try to find something that you enjoy doing, perhaps strolling in the garden. And that in that way, we might help you to build up that leg strength that you might need. We are a person-centered approach to therapy. So in other words, the individual client is really at the center of what we're doing. So many folks will say, well, what's this person's diagnosis? That's almost secondary to how we approach our clients. Yes, it's important to understand the waterfront of what their label might be at that time. But what's more important to us is really honing in on that individual, meeting them where they are at this place and time that has them before us for services, and figure out how we go from there. We like to think of the profession as being holistic. In other words, we're interested in how you are physically. We're interested in your social relationships. We're interested in how you think and your so-called cognitive function. We're interested in your emotional well-being and how you feel about getting out of bed every day and what the day presents you with. We're interested in your spiritual side, how you connect with something larger than yourself and whether or not that's important for you in your life. And then finally, we're also interested in, you know, what do you do for fun, for your leisure time? Do you have a balance there? Are there things that you can do? Or are you lacking in some skill, knowledge, or ability around leisure and what you do with that unobligated time in your life? Individualized, for sure. We're most interested in what the individual says their goals and needs and desires are, and then we work from there. We're also interested in that individual's significant others and their circle of family and friends, because that's really influential in how a person feels, typically. So we want to bring that part of their life into treatment as well. And then, you know, at the end of the day, we will meet with folks, we will talk about what's going on with them, we'll try to identify what they're struggling with, and then we'll try to set up a plan of intervention that really pulls on things that are motivating and exciting and interesting to them. And then we can exploit within those things that they've identified certain aspects of that to help them reach their outcomes. It might be helpful to have an example. So, Peter, I know you're an avid gardener, right?
Oh, yes. I especially like moving rocks around.
Moving rocks around the area. If you come to New Hampshire, we're called rock farmers. We have lots of rocks to move around. In any event, if we fast forward in your life, and I'm not saying this will happen to you, but this might be a typical case. If you were an avid gardener most of your life, and we fast forward to the latter part of your life, and perhaps you have developed mild or moderate dementia, and perhaps you find yourself living within maybe a nursing home or some kind of institution like that, and the staff begins to notice that you're becoming withdrawn, you're isolating yourself, maybe you're less mobile, you were walking when you came in, but now you're using a wheelchair if you ever elect to leave your room. And so you're really on a downward spiral. The recreational therapist would want to come and talk with you and do an assessment about what might be going on in your life at that time. And if people are at a loss as to how to help you improve your life, what we might do is start with your passion for gardening. And I could use gardening as a treatment modality with you. So maybe if I wanted to address you being withdrawn and really going inside yourself and not interacting with others, getting no quality of life, I might bring you to the garden with one or two other people, and we might begin to have a dialogue about the plants in a rather non-threatening way, just to see if we can stimulate some interest in you reengaging with others. And then if your issue were perhaps that you were immobile, okay? You're not functioning as well physically in your fine or gross motor. We might then get out a few tools, some adaptive equipment, and get you reaching and digging in the garden and getting back in touch with your tactile senses and the movement that brings joy to so many people. For you, moving those rocks around, I might have some rocks set up for you to actually move from point A to point B to reconnect you with that passion in your life. Hopefully that passion is something that's motivating, and that motivation will hopefully help you to re-engage in something that's more meaningful to you. How does that sound?
Well, it sounds wonderful. I'm hearing that you find ways to re-engage the disengaged.
Very much what
it sounds like what you're doing, and it's really interesting. It's a lot of what at times I'll do in my own therapy or counseling of people, but it sounds like it's more specific and knowledgeable and focused. I think all mental disturbance goes back to not being engaged in life, to not finding a way to love life, to love what you're doing, to love the people around you, and that everything else from obsessions and compulsions to depression and psychosis are all about not engaging life, not engaging in a genuine way the people in your life, the things you might want to do in your life, as well as things you see as your duty and your obligations. So I think what you're doing is a very, very good model. Where would anyone find at this point in time a recreational specialist? You're in New Hampshire.
Right.
Do you have a private practice?
I do not have a private practice, although there are individuals who do function in private practice. But if you're looking for a recreational therapist, there are going to be some very typical places where you're likely to find us. You will, of course, find recreational therapists in the so-called clinical settings, hospitals, rehab centers, long-term care facilities. Not all of them will have us, but many of them will. But you'll also find recreation therapists in your community. So you may find that your community parks and recreation or your municipal recreation department has a therapeutic recreation component to it, and that in that way you might identify a recreation therapist. You can also find them in school settings, working with students who have individualized education plans or IEPs. You might find us in recreation centers. You might find freestanding entities. You might find us actually working in homes. An example here in the New England region is the service arm of our department at UNH, and that's called Northeast Passage. And Northeast Passage is a nonprofit organization that provides both adaptive sports, but it also provides therapeutic recreation services that are home-based or community-based. So the therapist would actually go to the individual patient's home and work through an assessment and treatment plan and work with them over a period of time to help them hopefully take ownership of the process, and we will no longer need to be involved. A recreation therapist is happy if at the end of the day or at the end of treatment our patients no longer need us. That would be the ultimate outcome.
You know, it's all part of what I feel is this general field that I'm trying to identify of empathic therapy. It was interesting earlier, you sort of distinguished yourself from my field by saying, you know, in your field it's this way and in my field it's that way. But mm-hmm. my field is your field.
Sure.
It's empathic therapy. It's an approach that actually is person-centered, as you said. It's an approach that is caring, that seeks to empower the individual. All therapies need to empower the individual. And for those of you out there who are going to a psychiatrist or a therapist and you don't leave every session feeling empowered, feeling stronger, and instead you maybe feel a little more drugged and a little more diagnosed, it's not going to be good for you in the long run. I think what you're doing, Dr. Wilder, is something that is just a part of finding new ways to help people engage with life. And it's so much the opposite of where psychiatry has been taking us in the last few decades. I don't know how much you're critical of psychiatry or whether you want to get into that. It may not be good for you as a professor at New Hampshire. So you can approach that or not as much as you want. But it must be frustrating to you to see people on antipsychotic drugs so they can barely move their rocks or even want to.
You know, it is frustrating for individuals, I think, and, you know, I will leave that to the individual and their family and their doctors to decide what direction they want to go. But it is interesting, as a practitioner, particularly when I would offer people an alternative, and I think you talked about alternatives, maybe the false dichotomy. I think there are lots of ways that we can approach getting well. And when we come forward, we're absolutely a non-pharmacological approach to treatment and to getting your better and to have healing in your life. So, you know, what one chooses to do on the pharmacological end, I don't actually jump into that dialogue too much, but I do hold out the opportunity or the offer of something beyond that.
Yeah. I think so much of this is very deeply spiritual in nature. You know, human beings need to love life and they need to be grateful for life. I think of the Native Americans. They weren't any group to idealize, but they did have a philosophy of life that was about appreciating and loving the culture and loving the life around you and being grateful even to the corn that you ate and the peas that you ate and the deer that you killed, that you would be grateful and love life. And I think that recreation therapy just is right on target in trying to help and people to reengage and to motivate themselves to do things that they are going to enjoy, that are going to bring them pleasure and connect them to the world around you. I think if you love anything or anyone, you're not going to be crazy. You're going to be bringing out the best in yourself as a source of love. I think that's so fundamental, and I think that's what a lot of us have in common now who are trying new approaches.
I would agree, and just by way of illustrating what you said, very often the very first question we ask beyond "Hi, how are you doing?" is, "Tell me what you love to do." And that will throw the average patient, because there are very many people who are asking them, what do you bring to the table? What do you enjoy? What are your strengths? What gets you excited? And that's the approach that we take to jumping off the treatment ladder. So I think people are taken by that, but they're very appreciative of that approach.
The concept of recreation therapy, I certainly agree with you that it's really quite ancient. And during the 19th century, in the 1700s and the 1800s, there were small hospitals that really weren't hospitals. They were retreats, and they were usually run by Christians, including Quakers like the Tuke family in England.
Sure.
And they tried to keep the doctors out. They already, back in the late 1700s and the early 1800s, were talking about how we don't want to let the doctors in to give medicines and give drugs to our patients. And among the things that they encouraged was the enjoyment of life, of recreation, of exercise, of a good meal. And if a person was feeling out of control or manic, because they dealt with very disturbed people, they would give the person an opportunity to really exercise, to let the energy off. And then they would give the person a good meal to slow down their processes, and maybe a little wine. And then they would give them good company. We are so remote from that now in our institutional treatment of people, but I think you're helping move the concept of therapy in that direction, that holistic direction. Do you get training in counseling as a certified therapeutic recreation specialist? Because it sounds like some of what you're doing is very close to counseling.
Yes. In fact, there is some training that has to go on. It's not a profession that you can just do. You do have to have a minimum of a bachelor's degree and requisite coursework that covers the therapeutic recreation content, but would also cover psychological constructs, counseling constructs, anatomy, physiology, neurology, kinesiology. So we have to be prepared to work with a variety of individuals. So all of that training is part of the curriculum. Now, individuals can then choose to further bolster their academic preparation through getting minors, or if they really saw themselves in a more counseling type of environment, then they could go and get additional coursework there as well.
I would like to see more and more people trained at an earlier stage in counseling as a part of just opening this field up. I'd love to see people who have no more than a college degree and maybe less than a college degree getting trained in a variety of ways of helping people. I hope that you won't get over specialized and certified so that pretty soon you need have a PhD to go ahead and do this work.
Well, one could go all the way to the PhD level if they wanted to, but it remains one of the few allied health professions that you can still enter the field with a bachelor's degree. And to be sure, there is a lot of discussion within the profession about whether it should remain that way or not. The temptation is to look at your colleagues around the table in the allied health professions and go, well, if they all have to start at a master's, should we have to start at a master's? And, of course, physical therapy has gone to doctoral train as their entry level. So there is that pressure, and so far we have not gone down that road. But I can't speak for what the future will hold.
Mm-hmm. I think it doesn't sound like you get a heavy dose of counseling training, but I think that might be very useful to you too. Would be uh, to include more of the counseling aspect too, of learning to talk with people about what's mm-hmm. on their minds, because it sounds like you're doing that.
Mm-hmm. You can break down, there are sort of three kind of areas within therapeutic recreation that are broad areas where we might be giving service. So, for example, we call one area treatment, and that's where we're really targeting very specific functional outcomes. You know, if someone needs to improve their trunk stability because they now have paraplegia, then we're going to use recreation activities or activities of interest to the patient to help them to gain that stability. We also, though, work in an area called leisure education. And within the context of leisure education, we're really functioning as educators and counselors and facilitators. We're trying to help people to understand what is the role of leisure in your life. Most people have really never thought about it or talked about it in any very specific kind of way. And within leisure education, beyond improving a person's awareness of where leisure fits in their life, we might also actually teach them skills. For example, if you don't know how to garden and you have an interest in it, you need to develop some very specific skills to be able to do that, and so we would help a person with that. In addition to that, we might also teach them about the resources that are available to them. And you start right in your own room. You know, what resources are available to you here, where you are in this space? But then broadening that out. What about outside your room? What about outside your home? What about outside your community? What about outside your town? And we can keep getting larger and larger as we move out in helping people to identify the resources that are available to them. And so, and then lastly, the other domain is what we call recreation participation. And within this, you know, we've helped people to get new attitudes and get better in touch with who they are within the context of leisure. But now they need a chance to kind of practice that and do that in a way where they feel safe. And so within recreation participation, we facilitate a person's opportunity to just get engaged. And that might be that we take them out, someone with quadriplegia, and we take them water skiing. Or we take someone who has PTSD and we go and do a chess tournament with them. It just depends on what that person is interested in, and then we give them that opportunity with a little bit of support until they can take that on themselves.
Well, I like what you're doing. I think it's incredibly positive. What about the whole idea of recreation and work? I think that it's, and I'm sure you agree, that loving one's work is so important. And the more your work is just what you'd like to do for your recreation, the better life is. I've been blessed with loving to write. I think that my favorite recreation is writing. And it's not the center of my earning a living by any means. But I think there's quite a dovetailing. What about your thoughts about helping people to love their work?
Well, it's interesting because I can remember way back in my graduate preparation, I read this article called "Is Work True Leisure's Home?" And you think, wait a minute, aren't those opposite of each other? Isn't work one thing and leisure another? And, you know, if we dive into a little bit of the philosophy behind what we're doing within our field, you may be familiar with Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi and some of his work. I'm not sure if you're familiar with optimal experience and so forth. It's this notion that for someone to have an optimal experience, a few things have to be in play. And one of the things that has to be in play is this notion of choice or freedom of choice, or at least the perception that I'm engaging in something that I want to engage in. The next thing that ought to be there is that there should be a match between the challenge that the person has before them and their perception of their own skill set. So if I have a good match between those two things, I am very likely to experience something positive. So, for example, we just finished the U.S. Open. If someone said to me, I'm an intermediate tennis player. If someone said to me, hey, Allison, would you like to play Venus Williams in a match? Immediately my anxiety level goes up tremendously, and I'm guessing that Venus's anxiety level goes way down to boredom. So we don't have a good match there. But if I were to find someone who was about an intermediate player like myself and we were to play together, I'd feel like the challenge before me was up to the skills that I'm presented with. The next thing for the optimal experience is this idea of feeling intrinsically motivated. So doing the thing that you're doing because it benefits you, and not for some external reward or praise or trophy or anything like that, but because when you do this thing, you feel good, you feel joy, you feel, you know, whatever, and you're so engaged in this thing that perhaps time slips away, your sense of attending to the outside world diminishes, and you're really quite engaged. The last thing is the sense of personal causality, the idea that you believe in your heart that the outcome that you've attained through this thing that you've done is because of the effort you put in or the thoughtfulness that you put in, and it's not some external thing that has resulted in the outcome that you have. Now, in recreation and leisure, we tend to take all those four things and we call that defining leisure, but that thing could also define work. And so when you talk about work and leisure, you know, there we could be setting up that false dichotomy as well. I tell my students, I said, if you're in recreation therapy and every day you go to work is a joy, you've really done something smart for yourself, that you've managed to find a vocation that gives you the satisfaction of an avocation, and that's a wonderful mix. So that's my two cents on the work and leisure.
Well, and I think the work of the optimal concept that relates closely to the flow concept.
I was
expecting you to use the word
flow.
By the way, congratulations on pronouncing a name I've never been able to pronounce. I don't know if you have it in front of you to spell it, but I've read a little of that. What I like about this whole approach is it's about immersion again. It's about being in the flow. It's about finding yourself in what you're doing. And I think we just can't emphasize that enough, and therapists really need to be thinking along these lines. I'm going to take a break now. You're listening to, of course, who else could it be? Peter Breggin and Dr. Allison Wilder, who is at the University of New Hampshire. And we can go to break and to that music that always inspires me at any moment now.
You are listening to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour on the Progressive Radio Network. Stay tuned, stay in touch, and call in with your questions at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888.
And this is Dr. Peter Breggin. I don't put a lot of emphasis on callers, but we just made a call for callers because I think there's many people who might be interested in talking with Dr. Wilder about this approach that they have never heard of before and that they should hear more about. We left off talking about the flow, talking about the optimal experience. This is not fuzzy-wuzzy. This is what life is about. It is so much about finding recreation, work, relationships, where you feel you're in charge, you feel you're free, you feel you're responsible, you feel so engaged you're not even thinking about any of that because it's become a kind of second nature where you are really enjoying and being in charge of what you're doing. Something close to that may even involve giving some of the control over to someone else, but that's voluntary too, and that's a part of the beauty of the activity. This is not airy-fairy. This is how your conscience of psychiatry tries to live his life, and I would wish that for all of you. Welcome back, Allison Wilder.
Thank you.
Allison, tell people how they can get in touch with you.
If people would like to get in touch with me, they can simply go to the University of New Hampshire website, so unh.edu, and there are directories there, and if they type in Allison Wilder, they can find me that way, or they can also go allison.wilder@unh.edu, and there are two L's in my first name, so they can reach me that way.
Allison, what's on your mind right now? During the break, did you have some thoughts on where you'd like to pick up this conversation?
Well, interestingly enough, I did have some thoughts. And I went over to my bookshelf, and before we go too far, I want to spell Csikszentmihalyi for you.
Okay.
And for your listeners. It's CSIKSZENTMIHALYI. And I will have to say, I come by my pronunciation, honestly, I met Dr. Csikszentmihalyi at a conference that he was giving, and I had the opportunity to have lunch with him, and I was sure to pronounce his name correctly.
Well, you know, I read his work. I have somewhere in on my shelves, I have his work. And I, at the time, I was also reading, who was writing about being in the flow? I'm blocking on his name or her name. But it was sort of a part and a parcel of all of this. And it's about just, you know, finding a way of relating to life that's positive and good for you. And I think it always begins with loving, taking delight in, cherishing in some way what you're doing. It's just so important to the good life. And there'll be hard knocks. What I do often smacks me back in the nose, or worse. But it's still like even the toughest reform work is part of the flow that I think I'm supposed to be in.
Mm-hmm.
It's a part of my life.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because when you're a young profession like therapeutic recreation is, there are a lot of pressures or tensions that are outside the profession pulling it in one direction or another. You know, one direction would be let's go medical model, let's make sure we can get reimbursed by third party payers and let's really dive into that. You know, another pressure is, well, what do people want from us? What service are they not receiving that we might be in a position to provide? And so ultimately I think that all of us in recreation therapy strive to promote healthy states of being for the people that we work with, and really a high quality of life is the ultimate outcome. Improvements in function are important. They're critical. They're what pays the bills in terms of third-party reimbursements. But I think for the profession as a whole and for those of us as therapists, it's the existential outcomes associated with recreation therapy where the real magic happens. May I tell you a story?
I was going to ask you to tell us some stories.
Okay, wonderful. This is a story about Bob, and of course Bob is just a pseudonym, and Bob is not a particular person. He's sort of an amalgam of people, so he doesn't represent anyone in particular, but I think his story is one of illustration, and I think it's phenomenal. Bob returned from the Iraq War with a diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder and brain injury. And after Bob went through the system and was discharged, he got hooked up with the VA health system, and he had some inpatient recreation therapy while he was there, and it was discovered that he really was an avid outdoorsman. So then Bob is discharged from the rehab center, and he goes home to live in his community in this, we'll call it a small rural town in New Hampshire somewhere. And unfortunately, what then happened to Bob is he languished in the rural community without a lot of transportation, the fact that he had difficulty with mobility and some difficulty with his social relationships. His buddies stuck around, but they just didn't interact in the same way. They weren't going on hunting and camping trips. They weren't doing the things that they used to do together. So when they would hang out, all Bob could offer the group in terms of his input were stories from the past, things that they had done previously. And over the telling and retelling of the same stories, Bob became unhappy with that dynamic. He sort of felt less than within the context of his group of friends. These people were really the only support that he had in his area, and otherwise he would be completely isolated. So it was really important to him to stay connected with this group. And so as Bob, you know, further gets separated from his group and becomes less and less of an important part of that group and feeling less about himself, he begins to languish. Well, a friend says, hey, you know, I know of this place where you can go and you can get, you can go out and you can shoot guns again and you could hunt and maybe you can get out and do, I remember you telling a story about guns at the beginning of the hour, and you know, you could get out and do things. And he was just like, really, what's that about? And so he got connected with Northeast Passage, and that's an organization that's affiliated with the University of New Hampshire. And through Northeast Passage and the recreation therapists, they got Bob re-engaged with his passions and taught him some adaptive ways because of his mobility challenges to move through the woods, some alternative ways using four-wheelers and gun stands and things like that. And as he was able to problem solve with the therapist the barriers that prevented him from getting back involved in his passions, he was able to re-engage in doing that. But at the end of the day, the goosebumps from the story come from the fact that he sits down with this therapist maybe 6-8 weeks after he's been involved with Northeast Passage, and he's very excited. And the therapist is asking, "Well, what's going on, Bob?" And he says, "You'll never believe it, but now that I'm out doing this again, I'm part of the guys again. I have new stories to tell. I have new experiences with them. I'm part of the group again." So just overcoming those simple barriers that kept him from being outside and also made him outside his group, once we were able to address those challenges and then he saw a way to reengage in his passions, his life took on all new meaning and much deeper sense of belonging than he had prior to the intervention with recreational therapy.
That's a great story. I love that story. And I think it's real. I'm sure it actually happens in that way. I mean, you reintroduce a man to enjoying life, to loving life, to having stories and having buddies. And I think it's really important. And you know, the military are getting so badly treated right now. The soldiers who are identified as having any kind of emotional problem are all being put, virtually all of them, on multiple psychiatric drugs. I've talked to nurses who work at the way stations in various parts of the world where the soldiers stop on their way home. And every soldier who's identified with having any kind of psychiatric problem, according to nurses I've talked to, is on multiple psychiatric drugs, usually like more than 3, 4, 5, 6. Makes no sense at all. It shows the therapeutic impotence that my profession has dug itself into and how much better off all those young men and women would be if they had recreational therapists instead of MDs providing them medications that virtually make it impossible for them to again engage in life and love life. I'm just really glad you're there, and I want to encourage you and really everyone I'm talking to and working with to think of yourself as part of something whole and new, whether you call it empathic therapy or good therapy, but part of a movement now that is saying there are better things to do for people than what we've been doing traditionally in the field of medicine and psychiatry. And I sure hope that you won't join the group that's getting so heavily medicalized, and that you'll stay true to your principles. It's very, very hard to do right now, but it's critical to progress. It's critical to helping people. So I'm just delighted with what you're doing. Did you have any more stories you wanted to share, or other directions to take our conversation in? I'm happy to just bring out what's on your mind.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I think that even though there will, of course, there'll be changes in the profession as we move forward through time, I think one of the things that will not change, I think it's a central core value of the recreation therapy profession, and that is that we're person-centered, and that when we approach people, we approach them from a strengths perspective. So often, the medical profession approaches people from a deficit perspective, you know, starting with the diagnostic label and all that that means in terms of their lack of health. And within recreational therapy, we come at it from a strengths perspective. And what is it about you that we can capitalize on, that we can use to propel you forward from a place of strength already? And I think that's really critical. And because we start our relationship building from this strengths perspective and from this honoring the patient and what they need and where they are in time, what happens invariably is that the rapport, the relationship between the recreation therapist and the patient becomes quite deep quite quickly. And from that trusting place, this willingness to experiment and try and move on with life begins to blossom in that kind of an attitude. And so that, I hope, my sincere hope is that never goes away, and that continues to define the recreation profession, or particularly the recreation therapy profession.
Oh, I think it defines good therapy.
I would agree.
It defines good help. And we all share these values, those of us who are really looking beyond the medical model and beyond professionalism and really trying to be person-centered, to be empathic, to be empowering. And those of you out there, look for this in whatever help you're seeking, whether you're going to a recreational therapist, a social worker, a psychologist, a psychiatrist, but you're going to be hard-pressed to find one who thinks this way nowadays. You know, look for somebody who wants to understand your strengths, wants to empower you, wants you to enjoy your life, and to really move on in a positive way. And I don't care what the modality is that's being used. I don't care if you're a physical trainer or doing physical therapy or doing counseling or being a big brother or whatever, whether you're being a minister, whatever your approach is, or nursing on a ward, if your approach is the one that Alison Wilder is describing, you're going to help people and help them more than you ever imagined. So I'm really glad to see what you're doing. Alison, I hope you'll be coming to our conference in April. I mean, you're just going to fit in so good into the Empathic Therapy Conference. It's April 13th through 15th, folks. I'm going to start talking about it because it's not that far away anymore. And it's going to be in Syracuse, as it was last year. We're going to have people from around the world again, all thinking around these kinds of issues and trying to bring to it the whole empowerment of other human beings. Alison, how did you get into this field, and how did you develop these principles and ideals that you have? Did you have them before you got into this field?
Well, I think, you know, growing up, family recreation was highly prized in my family. We played together games. We argued over games. You know, I fought with my brothers, but ultimately we ended up doing a lot of things together. And so I had a fairly substantial what we call bag of tricks in terms of recreational interests. And so as I got closer to that time where you have to get a college and figure out what you're going to major in, sitting in the guidance counselor's office, going, well, I like sports, but I don't want to be a physical educator. And I like, you know, being outdoors, but I don't know if there's a career in that. And I honestly stumbled onto it at orientation at Ithaca College. And I think if you ask 10 recreation therapists, how did you find the profession, 9 will say they stumbled on it. We need to do a much better job of promoting ourselves as a profession, which is one of the reasons I'm so grateful to have the opportunity to talk to you and your audience today. But it is a bona fide profession, and you can find it. For me, I stumbled on it and then went on to get a master's. And after my master's...
And what was the master's in?
The master's is actually in recreation and leisure studies with an emphasis in therapeutic recreation.
So this was at Ithaca College.
That was at State University of New York, Cortland, where my master's was from.
In Cortland. And then your undergraduate was at Ithaca. And I guess that's why we met, because we met at a party in the Ithaca area where you were coming back to visit a friend.
That's correct.
Yes, so we have these common roots. Well, I wouldn't say I have roots in Ithaca. I've been in Ithaca now in this area for 10 years. My God, I've been here for 10 years. Saying it is a little overwhelming. Yes, I've been here for 10 years. I love Ithaca College. I think that it's one of the more student-oriented colleges. Would you agree with that?
I would agree with that. I loved my time at Ithaca. And Ithaca, actually, with regard to recreational therapy, has the distinction of being one of the few undergraduate institutions in the country that has what we call a freestanding degree in therapeutic recreation. So what I mean by that is that very often when you look for therapeutic recreation, you will find it housed in something called recreation leisure here at university. It's called recreation management and policy. But the general heading is recreation. And then within in that you'll find emphasis or track areas in therapeutic recreation or recreational therapy. Ithaca College has, you will find, when you look for majors, you will find a major called recreational therapy. So that's quite interesting, and that's that speaks to their value of the degree, and there are a lot of resources put into it. So I'm quite proud to call myself an Ithaca alum.
And your doctorate?
Now, my doctorate was born out of my desire to teach. I had been filling in and doing some adjuncting at Virginia Commonwealth University in Richmond, Virginia, in their recreation and sport management program, which had a TR emphasis. And, you know, as fate would have it, a professor left and they needed someone to fill in for a year. And I thought, well, now time to make the leap. And so I was teaching while I was pursuing my doctorate in, it's in education. However, I also have a postmaster certificate in gerontology. So I really went and tracked down studying the aging phenomenon and how therapeutic recreation fits in with older adults.
You know, I think some of the most imaginative, person-centered work is being done in the area of dementia and the elderly. It's an interesting phenomenon because a lot of people around the country now are working on drug-free approaches to helping the elderly and to helping people with brain disorders, mm-hmm. genuine brain disorders like Alzheimer's. Mm-hmm. It's interesting that you found your way into that area. Tell me more about your work with the elderly and how much you can accomplish with your approach.
Okay. The working with older adults has been a passion for a long time. I actually started in youth corrections. It's kind of a funny story. And that's a very challenging field. And I liked it to a certain extent, but it wasn't my cup of tea. And everybody has to find their niche. So I went from youth corrections, which was kind of a dramatic and sometimes violent setting, to working in long-term care in an assisted living facility, actually in Ithaca. And it took me about 3 months to feel like I could sit in the dining room without having my back to the wall, and that everybody who was approaching me didn't have an ulterior motive in mind. So I just fell in love with older people and the richness of their stories and how this idea that you could be having a conversation with somebody one day, think you know all about them, and then you uncover this pearl or this gem about who they were and their life story. And it was just, it's exciting stuff. And then as I delved a little deeper and I began to see some of the ways in which ageism represents itself in our country and you know, this notion of denigrating older persons and sort of subjugating them to, you know, life in dreary long-term care facilities, that was something I wanted to see if I could make a difference in. The good news at this point is that long-term care in and of itself is undergoing what they call culture change. And culture change is in long-term care really means this idea of, wow, we should make our institutions more person-centered, more friendly to the individual. So instead of having you have to have your peanut butter and jelly sandwich between noon and one, if you get a craving for a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, perhaps it ought to be available to you whenever you would want it, like it was in your home. So in these small changes in trying to understand the needs of the individual, I think long-term care is really transforming itself. They've taken a page out of disability services, who for a long time has held the opinion that, you know, the individual is a central player in this mix and that services ought to be designed to help that person become all that they can become across their lifespan. So that's really gratifying to see. So, in fact, my two passions come together. Working with individuals with lifelong disabilities has been a passion, but guess what? They're getting older now. So at the turn of the 19th century, or excuse me, the 20th century, about early 1900s, if you had Down syndrome, you could expect to live to be about 19 years old. Today, you can expect to live well into your 50s and 60s and maybe even beyond because of advances in healthcare and advances in social policy and advances in all kinds of things that have helped that equation to develop over time. But Folks with developmental disabilities, particularly if they're fairly involved, cerebral palsy or perhaps Down syndrome, tend to express aging prematurely. And so whereas they may be experiencing early stage dementia at age 40 or 50 as opposed to age 60, 70, or 80, the problem is that services for folks who have dementia are really tied to this chronological age of 60. If you want to be eligible for age administration on aging programs, you have to meet that age threshold. Well, there's this whole population of people that could benefit from the services aimed at older adults, but they haven't met the age threshold yet. So I've spent a considerable amount of time doing research on how we serve individuals who are aging with lifelong disabilities, in particular intellectual disabilities. And right now what we're discovering is that so far it seems like it's pretty much a one-size-fits-all, and that's sort of counter to our idea of individuation and really meeting the client where they are with the services that they really need at that time. So I've been working at trying to understand that phenomenon and eventually hope to make some inroads and some changes with regard to how people become eligible for services and what kinds of opportunities are available to them and when.
Well, Allison Wilder, I love your attitude toward other human beings. And I think that everything you're saying epitomizes the best approach that we can have to people. And it's so interesting to me to hear that that you bring this to people who are aging, you bring this to people who are disabled mentally, literally disabled physiologically, and you do it because you value people. And I think if there is a revolution in the way we treat people, it's the revolution of treasuring them. And I think that the reason why people with Down syndrome now live longer is we have learned to treasure them and to value them and to appreciate them as human beings. And that's what all of our work is about. Every single movement forward, I believe, is about treasuring human beings. We're getting down toward the end of our hour now. It's 6 o'clock on my clock. I want to thank Allison Wilder for being on the show. She's not just a certified therapeutic recreation specialist. I really do believe that you are an example of the therapist at her best. I really do appreciate the way you think about helping people, the way you value people, and I think that that is what it is all about. Two words of goodbye, Allison?
I just want to thank you for the opportunity to share this wonderful profession with your audience and encourage your listeners to go find out more about it and certainly to contact me if they have questions.
Thank you very, very much. And I'm going to be saying goodbye to our wonderful audience and wish you well.
You've been listening to the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with a new live show every Monday evening at 5 p.m. East Coast time on the Progressive Radio Network, where each show is archived for your convenience. You can learn more about Dr. Bregan and his lifelong reform work on www.bregan.com. That's B-R-E-G-G-I-N.com.